This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavours, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
The UVF show of strength at the weekend is our top story today. Lining of the East Belfast route, says the Belfast Telegraph, seen as a display of support for the area leadership. What's this story all about? Well, you'll find out if you join us on this podcast today. Also, Mike Parry wondering if we should all now get our England T-shirts on, Northern Ireland not playing, of course, and support England. What a boring match last night. Anyway, all coming up this morning.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here at The Nolan Show from the BBC. Don't forget, our lines are open right now, 030 30 80 55 55. Also, please don't forget you can listen to The Nolan Show whenever you want. It doesn't have to be live at 9 o'clock in the morning. If you prefer listening to it when you're going to bed, when you're going to the gym, when you're going to work, when you're coming out of school, then it is there on BBC Sounds. Download the app and it's there for you on BBC Sounds. Our top story today, a massive show of strength by the UVF in East Belfast in broad daylight. The Belfast Telegraph is reporting UVF members from other battalions were bussed in to support an event organised by those who have pledged their allegiance to the Shankill Road leadership. The leadership is a reference to the so-called new brigadier of the UVF in the area. I've been speaking to the Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent, Alison Morris.
On Saturday, there was a memorial parade to a UVF man who was murdered by the IRA in 1988, Robert Seymour. That takes place every year. There's nothing particularly unusual about that. But what was unusual about this parade was that over 1,000, some are saying 1,500, men dressed in white shirts and black ties who are reported to be members of the UVF who were mobilised by the Shankill Road leadership lined the road at one stage that stretched quite a considerable distance, and this was said to be in support of the new UVF leader who was put in place following that Memorial Day statement that was made last November. That was read at quite a few memorial events. So the UVF said it had stood down the leadership of the East Belfast UVF and accused some of them, unnamed people, of criminality.
So this is in broad daylight on the Shankill Road, a show of strength by 1,500 people.
So this was in the Newtownards Road in East Belfast, but a lot of the people who were present would have been set by the Shankill Road leadership. So the UVF has it's different, I suppose, when we talk about paramilitary groups. A lot of them are very fractured. They've been involved in numerous feuds, and some of them have leaderships that are completely autonomous. They just look after themselves. The UVF remain under a central leadership, which is based in the Shankill, and involves quite older men, I'd say, some of them quite elderly. In recent years, they've been involved in civilianisation, transitioning, whatever it is you want to call it. And that was said to be at a very advanced stage because some of those older leaders wanted that to take place before they step down, retire, or move on. And in some cases, I think some of them are in quite bad health. And that had been on with the British and Irish government. So this was meant to be a period of sort of transitioning to a civilian life, getting rid of the structures that exist, which many people would ask why they still exist in 2024, and become a sort of old boys memorial club. But then we have events like Saturday, where that was clearly an act that was quite intimidating. I mean, the pictures of it are quite startling. And it was intended to be a sign, I think, to those who are not loyal to the Shankill leadership and who remain loyal to that East Belfast faction and the leader of that East Belfast faction.
Look, I don't want to sound naive about this. We've had decades of troubles in Northern Ireland. This so-called word transitioning clearly has not fully happened yet, Alison. But the picture that is within your newspaper today, the Belfast Telegraph, there's two PSNI officers at the front of this parade, and then there's men, black trousers, white shirts, black ties, lining the streets behind them. Is it right for the police to be present, describing this this parade as having proceeded, quote, without incident? How is a show of strength by the UVF not an incident in itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do have some insight into this because I checked a lot of this yesterday. So the parade itself was legal. They had applied for permission from the Parades Commission. That had been granted for the band parade, which, as I said, takes place every year. But what was unusual is the sheer numbers who were bussed in from other places. And this was on what I've been told was on the orders of the UVF leadership, that these people were to show up on this day dressed in a particular way and were to line the route, and that this was to be a message that was being sent. So the police, I believe, were aware, and there had been some rumours on social media and some messages being sent around to say that there was going to be violence, that after this parade people were going to be forced from their homes and all sorts of other things. That all turned out to be sort of online, you know, rubbish speculation, and the police had made efforts during the week, it's my understanding, to contact some people to ask, was this going to be the case? Was there a potential for any violence? And we're told no, there wasn't. I don't think that what the PSNI were expecting was this sort of show of strength. They were expecting the band parade, of course, that had been applied for, and therefore the policing of that would have been more routine, I suppose, as in like a traffic policing. But what it turned into is something that, you know, most normal people would look at that and say, in 2024, is this genuinely what kind of society that we live in, that we have, you know, paramilitary groups who can literally come and take over an area? And also the numbers of people involved will, I think, be concerning, because most people wouldn't be aware of how many UVF members that still exist in Northern Ireland, but clearly they're able to mobilise huge amounts of people at, you know, at very short notice.
How do we know these people lining the streets were not simply there, all dressed the same, for this Robert Squeak Seymour parade? How do we know it's a show of strength for the current leadership?
Well, it would be very unusual for 1,500 people to just automatically show up dressed the same. But I do know that this has been going on for several days now, that this has been being briefed to people that there was going to be this show of strength, and that the UVF leadership were going over to show support to the new leader that they put in place in East Belfast following that Remembrance Day statement. And this has been verified with numerous sources. You know, I like to double check and triple check everything that I do. And there are other people as well who are in that community who would be people who would be church figures, and other people who the PSNI would contact when they want to make sure that there isn't going to be violence, and that they do know that they can police something appropriately. And they were all contacted during the week about this as well.
This new so-called brigadier, what do we know about that person?
Well, what we do know is that this person is someone who has been a long-standing member of the UVF for quite some time. They do have a conviction, albeit it's for a different kind of offence, a sort of dishonesty offence. But they were put in place. They have probably maybe around 30 to 50 people around them. But the majority of that East Belfast UVF faction stayed with their previous leader, the person that I suppose the Shankill would like to be gone, but hasn't. And so we do see that there's friction there, that in the past, if I had been reporting on this, and I have reported on numerous loyalist feuds over the years, in the past this was something that was very likely to have ended in violence. It hasn't went down that road, and for that I suppose that is progress of some sort, but it does, I think, still show the grip of paramilitaries and the amount of authority and power that those paramilitary leaders still will, that they were able to organise something like this. And it will also be of concern to the British and Irish government and the people who are helping fund this transition, because a lot of this involves a lot of work that's being done at a community level to help this transition when they see something like this. Because those pictures, does that look like to you like a paramilitary group that's preparing for its end game, that's preparing to stand down and dismantle its structures, or does that look like someone who is flexing their muscles?
Is this whole transitioning a con job on the public? Is transitioning with the UVF, money is funneled to paramilitary gangsters and it keeps them relatively quiet, but they've no intention of transitioning. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's always been my opinion that if anyone was going to transition, they'd have transitioned quite some time ago. And there are examples of paramilitary groups in areas that have completely transitioned and civilianised, and they've either just either went away or some of their members are involved in really progressive, I suppose, community and even cross-community work. But the majority of those paramilitary groups haven't transitioned in any meaningful way. And there's numerous reasons for that. As I mentioned, there was a number of loyalist feuds that took place around the late 90s and early 2000s, and therefore they believed there was safety in numbers and that they would stay in place because of that. There's also, as you said, there's money in this.
What type of money is involved here, Alison? What type of money would be funneled to the UVF through so-called transitioning money?
Well, there's obviously illegal money being made, and that would then deter people from wanting to dismantle their structures because that would stop. But when it comes to the legal aspect of the money, there are people who are being paid considerable amounts of money to be involved in transitioning projects. So that might include maybe looking at the future of bonfires and parades in certain areas. It may be discussions around flags and when flags are flown or not flown. It may also be involved in, to some degree, some kind of work within the community with women's groups. And all of that is all funded, some of it through the British and Irish government, some of it through EUP.
And obviously that's not money, transition money to the UVF. That's transitioning money to groups that might be able to persuade the UVF to stop.
Yeah, and groups that are maybe run by loyalist ex-prisoners, so groups that would have very strong links to loyalism, and but they would be carrying out this work, and there's funding that goes through that work. And there's different waves of funding come at different times. Sometimes there's less, sometimes there's more. But you know, there are some people, and there's a very small group of people who are being paid to try and move this transition along, and we can see that that's not really happening.
And final question, Alison. Again, I'm not trying to sound naive, but when the PSNI say that they've gathered evidence around this, everybody knows who the new leadership is, right? So if they ordered all of these men on the street, can we expect our police force to in any way gather intelligence around that order? Can we expect anybody that showed this show of strength to be scooped? Or is that not how Northern Ireland works?
Probably bizarrely the latter. It's not how Northern Ireland works. But what I will say is the parade itself was legal. The band parade itself was legal. But what wasn't expected was a show of strength for these men lined each side of the road. I am pretty sure that has to be some kind of offence, because the Parades Commission ruling did not allow for that. That in no way was that part of the Parades Commission ruling, and that sort of obstruction, I suppose, of the highway. You could argue that these are quite minor offences, and obviously they didn't wear paramilitary style uniforms. They all dressed in black and white, so white shirts, black ties and black trousers, so it looked very uniform and like people who were clearly all together, but they were careful to stay away from anything that had a UVF logo on it that then might make that legal. So it's all been thought out, I think, very well in advance.
Okay. Alison Morris, thank you very much indeed. So 03030805555 is our number this morning. The police are in no doubt, by the way, that the people who were present, that is linked to ongoing tensions within the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, in other words, an organisation that maims and kills and extorts money out of people. So in broad daylight, on a main arterial route, here we have now a show of strength. Will it affect their money in any way? And I'm not talking about the money that they prize out of business people. You know, the wee brown envelope at the end of the week that still goes on, that they're still collecting protection money. I'm talking about this so-called transitioning money. Is that wee pipeline going to be cut off at all? Or what is everybody going to do? Shrug our shoulders? Ah, there we go. Little show of strength for paramilitary gangsters. Ah, there. That's Northern Ireland. And it goes on year after year after year. Is that what we're going to do? 030-30-80-55-55. And it wasn't a little show of strength. 1,500 men. Norman, good morning.
Morning, Steve. It's absolutely terrible what's going on in this country. They say for God and Ulster, they wouldn't even know what a church or a Bible looked like. These are paramilitary gangsters, drug dealers, extortion, criminality. And here we have Stormont Fountain, these communities that these people run. And the Secretary of State promised them $3 million of the transition. They've no notion of transition. They're making too much money out of the racketeering and drug dealing. And that's on both sides of the community, public and onlookers. They're both working hand in hand on their drug dealing. So they are. And our young people are getting drew into these organisations and ending up with criminal records. And this country has lost its way because these paramilitary have no notion of going away. And while you feed them money, they will not go away.
Well, the police were
in the fountain stopped.
The police were there with their body cam. Let's see how many people are scooped.
There's been none scooped, Stephen. The police have lost control of the streets. These paramilitary run the streets. They run their communities. People are afraid to speak out against them. And that's what's wrong in society here. People are afraid of these paramilitaries. We've seen young ones kneecapped and shot dead because they spoke out or went against these paramilitaries.
Another question is, next year, when the Parade Commission looks at whether it will give permission for this or not, these 1,500 people who the PSNI are saying were there as part of the tension within the UVF, will this be a determination at all next year? Will there be an extra stipulation that there shouldn't be thousands of men in black trousers, white shirts, black ties, lined along the street who the police are saying is linked to tensions within a paramilitary organisation?
It doesn't matter what the police say. These people can march up and down the roads at their own leisure, the same as the IRA can march up and down the roads and the commemoration Easter Sunday and all, and the police are just taking photographs. But that's all happens. Nobody's brought before the courts. Nobody's jailed. They have lost control of the streets, the police, and the paramilitaries can do as they please. And that's what's wrong with our society.
Well, so it is. Let's see. Of course, it might be difficult for the PSNI, and that was any offence, criminal offence, actually caused. I don't know. When they send this parade passed without incident, passed off without incident, their exact words. Well, what they mean was there was no violence. But is it not an incident concerning to the PSNI what happened on that road?
It is concerned, Stephen. When you look at what happened in Newton Ards, a few of them on there, people put out of their homes, had to flee Newton Ards. And they were at it in the South Antrim Brigade or North Antrim Brigade, and the Shankill and East Belfast had their feud. It's gone on, so it is their feud. So it is. These people are just gangsters. It's like the mafia. You shouldn't call them paramilitaries.
Well,
like
Brandon Enniskillen, you were there. You say there were more balaclavas than bellies, or more bellies than balaclavas. Is that right?
I passed through before it started on my way somewhere else. That's what I'm saying to your researcher. But I was delighted to see that there was more bellies than balaclavas for a start. But look, we just have to deal with this propaganda rubbish. And let's not forget they got permission, which disgusts me also. But it is what it is, and we have to put up with it. But I wanted to say to you this. This is now time that all grants, these so-called transition grants, are removed immediately, because that's the bit that insults me. I can, if I'm honest with you, put up with these parades, because they'll gradually filter out in years to come. But the one description that has been left out, and I think it was Alison Morris started to use it, which was a form of grooming of youngsters. And that's what really drew my mind to say, enough of this paramilitary grant-funded schemes for bonfires, parades, etc. They are destroying young men and women's lives, and that's the point. And Norman's quite right. They wouldn't know where a Bible nor a church is.
Well, how does building a bonfire destroy anyone's life?
Because it installs that old-fashioned tribalistic rubbish which the majority of us have brought our children up to remove ourselves from and stay away from, because it is a form of lynch mode capturation of youngsters. You saw it before when Spotlight have done programs. You had youngsters at bonfires in loyalist areas talking about them and us. I've hardly ever met.
I think there is a fair question this morning when we're looking at the bigger picture around this transitioning money. In the context, every day, I have someone contacting this show, lots of people contacting the Nolan Show, in pain with the health service, cannot get seen to. There are big demands on money for education. Look at the Education Minister, Paul Given, looking for money for special educational needs. Naomi Long's looking for money for justice, and so it goes on and on. How are we affording, in this current climate, this transitioning budget? And I'll tell you what, I don't see any transitioning budget for an elderly person that's sitting at home, and if you listen to the BBC News this morning, is waiting 5 years for a home care package. Where's the transitioning money for the elderly community? Where's the transitioning money for 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds sitting on waiting lists in pain? Where's the transitioning money for kids going into schools which are not fit for purpose? And yet Northern Ireland PLC can afford to still send money to these gangsters. And the money, the transitioning money, by the way, if it is going to some of these gangsters and not the legitimate groups trying to stop them, that's just a top-up. That's a top-up on top of the protection racket where they're still going out every week and they're collecting protection money. And if you don't pay it, you get burnt out.
That's right. Yeah. Can I speak?
Yes.
Right. Yes. Thank you very much. You're quite right. And also you left out a list of like cataract operation, hip operations and so forth. And we could go on. But back to Alison Morrison's main point a couple of years ago, which was the grooming of youngsters. So that's why I want all funding removed from them. And part of our healthcare waiting list is probably held back due to the fact that we're funding these complete gangsters and mobsters, or as you refer to as scumbags, and which is a brilliant description. But thank you for giving me the time to speak this morning, Stephen.
Brian, thank you. Next, the next Irish government needs to push hard for United Ireland. This is the call from the former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar speaking in Belfast over the weekend. He was interviewed at an Ireland's Future event. He said there was a need to step up preparations for a possible end to the border, including setting aside funding to pay for it. Mr. Varadkar also told the audience that there needed to be a stronger apology from IRA supporters for the group's actions during the Troubles in order to win over hearts and minds of Protestant people.
I often hear people who are Republicans who maybe would have been supporters or involved in the IRA in the past, when they give apologies, it's kind of a general language, you know, apologies for what happened and everyone suffered and what everyone did. I think if we're going to start to change minds and hearts among Protestant people, a much more stronger, specific apology for what was done and what we did, I think would help to change some hearts and minds.
Well, our correspondent Mark Simpson with us this morning. Good morning to you, Mark.
Morning, Stephen.
So there we have a former Taoiseach saying there needs to be a stronger apology from the IRA and indeed the Irish government.
Yes, this is Leo Varadkar unleashed. He didn't say the sorts of things that he said on Saturday while he was in office. He's no longer Taoiseach. He may not even run again in the next Irish election. So we're seeing a very different Leo Varadkar. And his comments, although challenging to parts of the audience on Saturday, went down well, especially the bit you mentioned at the top, saying to the Irish government, you need to push harder for a united Ireland. He was very much preaching to the converted at most of those 2,000 or so people gathered on Saturday.
And so, Mark, what reaction has there been to what Mr. Varadkar has said?
Well, as we know, Ireland's future doesn't enjoy universal approval. Some people believe it's just a Sinn Féin front pushing for United Ireland. The organisers would deny that completely and say that everything said on Saturday should be part of a discussion about where we're at the moment. Stephen, your programme covers it very well, all of the big issues of the day, whether they're in terms of the health service, paramilitarism that you've just dealt with comprehensively there, public services, the finances, the budget. But the elephant in the room is still the constitutional question. And those behind Ireland's future say we need to talk more about it. Yes, many unionists say it's a Sinn Féin front. But if you look at that, certainly on paper at least, it's definitely not. You look at the chief executive, who's a football agent, Jerry Carlisle. There's a lawyer, Niall Murphy. There's a political commentator, Brian Feeney. I think the jury's out in terms of whether or not this Ireland's future group will actually make much of an impact. They didn't fill the hall on Saturday, but it certainly was a fascinating discussion.
Is there any discussion within this Ireland's Future event as to how Northern Ireland may be better off staying in the UK? Like, is there ever any reasonable discussion around that?
Well, that's what unionists would say, and that's why Jim Allister wasn't there on Saturday, surprise, surprise. Doug Beattie wasn't there, seen as a much more liberal unionist. Gavin Robinson wasn't there. They believe they're being invited to a discussion which already has a predetermined outcome. And that's why I think it's highly unlikely, as things stand, Stephen, we'll see any mainstream unionists at Ireland Future events. But a former DUP member, Wallace Thompson, was there, and the loyalist Davy Adams was there. Some unionists do believe it is at least worth talking.
And Naomi Long pulled out.
Yeah, so Nuala McAllister was there. This may partly explain the turnout, which was less than, by my reckoning, roughly, as I say, around 2,000, there were 4,500 seats out. It wasn't a great day to have an event like this. A lot of people were out campaigning. If we take her at face value, that's why Naomi Long says she didn't want to be there. I spoke to a Sinn Féin candidate in a marginal seat. He only arrived around 4 o'clock because he was out canvassing. I think that is one of the reasons why there wasn't a great turnout in terms of the whole capacity of the SSE arena on Saturday afternoon.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Morning to you. Austin Stack is with us today. Austin's father, Brian, a senior Irish prison officer, was murdered by the IRA in 1983. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar saying there needs to be a stronger apology from IRA supporters for their actions during the Troubles and from the Irish government?
Well, Stephen, I would certainly agree with him in relation to an apology from the IRA. But apologies are something that have to be meaningful. An apology is something that an organisation gives if they accept responsibility for what they have done. And what we have seen over the last number of years in particular is Sinn Féin representatives saying there was no alternative to their campaign of terror. And in my view, that doesn't lead us to believe that if there is an apology ever issued, that it would be in any way, shape or form meaningful. And I mean, I can remember at the time of the loyalist ceasefires, Gusty Spence giving what I felt was quite a meaningful apology at the time. But, apologies are something that have to be taken by the people affected. And, it's all very well and fine to say the words, I'm sorry, but, it doesn't mean anything. If the Sinn Féin people still commemorate terrorists in a very public way, I have no difficulty with them commemorating dead terrorists behind closed doors. Everybody has a right to remember their loved ones. But to rub victims' faces in it, and at the same time then, maybe a day later say, oh, we're very sorry for what happened. In my mind, it just doesn't add up. And while an apology would be very welcome if it was heartfelt, if it was meaningful, if it came with an acceptance of responsibility, Stephen. Yesterday was the 40th Father's Day without my dad. What? And, we would have loved to have had him, in the house with his grandchildren. And that didn't happen for the last 40 years because of the IRA.
What Leo Varadkar is saying is that along the journey towards a united Ireland, that needs to happen first. What difference would it make? Would it actually further the likelihood of a united Ireland?
Well, I think what we need to do first, Stephen, you know, I would be very much of the same mind as, you know, Micheál Martin on this, in that we need to unite people rather than unite territory. And by uniting people first, you know, I know an awful lot of unionist people in Northern Ireland, and some of them are quite fearful of coming down to the Republic. And they still have that fear. They still, you know, think that, you know, they will be demonised. You know, as Protestant people were here in the past, we did have a very, you know, the Catholic Church had a prominent place in our constitution. You know, so there is still that lingering thing there. But, you know, Ireland is very much, the Republic of Ireland is very much a secular society today. There's very much, you know, people down here don't care, you know, whether you're a nationalist or a unionist, whether you're a Protestant or a Catholic or a Muslim, we've gone past all that. And that's why I'm a firm believer if we unite people, that if we show people, I'm a nationalist, I want to see United Ireland, but I don't want to see it evolve in a situation where we're going to have more bloodshed, where we're going to have more, you know, bombings and killings and unnecessary heartache for people. And I would be firmly of the view that first we unite people, firstly that we talk to people, we engage with people, that we, you know, show unionists that there is no fear in the United Ireland.
Would it make a difference to you? An apology?
At this stage, an apology to me wouldn't make any real difference, because I don't think it would have any meaningful effect. Yes, if Sinn Féin were to, and the IRA were to accept responsibility for what they did, and this is key to where I'm coming from, the IRA are still not accepting full responsibility for my dad's murder. They've gone about 70% of the way there, but they're refusing to accept full responsibility and say that the murder of my dad was sanctioned when I know that it was. You know, so little things like that. They're still, you know, they're still hiding behind, you know, things like it wasn't sanctioned. If they come out and just say, yes, we did this, we accept responsibility.
Where was your father when he was killed?
How old was he?
Where was he?
Oh, where was he? He was coming out of the National Boxing Stadium in Dublin after the National Boxing Finals. And, Stephen, that's an event that I like what I'm talking about. The Irish Amateur Boxing Association is a cross-border institution. There are boxers from Belfast, from Antrim, from Derry, come down and box in the National Finals. You know, the two men that attended to my dad on the night, that saved his life on the night initially, were two Belfast doctors. This is the stuff I'm talking about, Stephen. This is what I'm talking about. We unite people, not territory first.
When Michelle O'Neill said there was no alternative to the violence of the past, did you interpret that as violence associated with people like your father? Did that have an impact on you when she said that?
Absolutely, it did have an impact, Stephen, because it meant what she was actually doing was saying it was all right to murder my dad. That it was okay to murder my dad.
And obviously she wasn't specifically talking about the murder of your father, but when she did say no alternative to the violence of the past and didn't distinguish, and then that had a very much an impact on you.
It absolutely did have an impact on me, Stephen, because even though she wasn't referring specifically to my dad, the IRA have admitted that their people murdered my dad. And that, in my view, when she says we had no alternative to do what we did, you know, that the IRA had no alternative to do what they did, that specifically means to me that they had no alternative to murder my dad than to murder my dad. And, you know, that's, you know, tough. It means that they're, you know, rubbing my face in it. You know, my mother is sitting at home listening to stuff like that. You know, Stephen, if we're going to talk about apologies, that other stuff has to stop first.
Kevin Maher, the commentator, with us today. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Stephen.
So, Liv Radd, you're saying on the road to United Ireland, there needs to be this apology from the IRA and the Irish government.
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to say, look, let's try and level the account. Let's try and address the past and kind of cap it off, really. And of course, this is the challenge, the eternal challenge, obviously, with Northern Ireland. There is so much painful history. So much painful history on the island of Ireland over the last 100 years that it kind of clouds the way forward, really. And you know, it is very difficult because, you know, apologies can be made, and do they erase the past? Do they ease the past? It's all in the eye of the beholder, and everybody will react and want different things from an apology and from a reconciliation of the past. I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult to do that, and difficult to do it in a one-sided sense as well, given everybody's got something to be regretful for and apologise for on all sides. But I think for me, Varadkar's comment, the most interesting comments he was making was that actually it's now incumbent on future Irish governments to plan for this rather than this to be a kind
Why
of
didn't he do
aspirational.
It?
Oh, very good question. You should get him on and ask him. I would like to hear that, really. I mean, his argument is, look, free from the kind of confines of a programme for government with coalition partners, he's a bit more able to speak his own mind and wants to play some part in the future shape of Ireland, which, great, fabulous. Often prime ministers and senior ministers...
But when he says the next Irish government...
...rediscover principles when they're no longer confined by office.
When he says the next Irish government needs to push hard for a united Ireland... What does pushing hard mean? What more could they do?
I think it's recognising that the game's afoot, and I think pretty much everybody would recognise that. The issue of Ireland's future constitutional status is, you know, the most overwhelming political issue on both sides of the border. It's constantly talked about. Clearly, I talk about it and write about it quite a bit, but so does everybody else. And I think people can sense that change is afoot in some measure, and actually to talk about that, to discuss what that might be, to try and get some sense of a timeline, and crucially, what shape that change might be. What does a united Ireland look like? You know, I mean, you know, as I say, we can look to the past and the reconciliation of the past, which is massively difficult. Where we should be in this conversation is looking forwards to say, what would this thing be like? How would people benefit from it? We've got a mechanism for bringing this about in the Good Friday Agreement. That's to one side. The timescale about how that works is slightly opaque, but that's becoming clearer. But what does this thing like? What is this thing like? How does everybody on the island of Ireland benefit from there being a united Ireland? That's where the conversation should be. And I think that's, in a sense, what Varadkar was trying to get at.
Austin Stack, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for being on this morning. Kevin, stay there. Peter's in Banbridge, 03030805555 is our number. Morning, Peter.
Hello, yes, Stephen. Nice to talk to you. No, I'm listening to the programme as I always do. I believe I don't know how to apologise. I know nothing about the IRA. But I'm asking, will the British apologise for partitioning Ireland? It was partitioned by force in 1920s, I'm not too good at years, when Michael Collins was over in London, and Lloyd George said, sign, or we'll be back at war tomorrow.
Well, the former Taoiseach, Peter, thinks that it would help along the journey towards a united Ireland if the IRA did apologise.
And I agree. I'm not saying don't. I have nothing to do with IRA.
But why would they apologise? Do you think their apology, if they did, would be in any way sincere? Did they not enjoy killing and maiming and blowing up people?
I'm not too sure.
Or was that not their goal? Like, they didn't do it by mistake, did they?
Well, they didn't waken up one morning and decide to hate the British. They didn't and fight the British. That meant Britain come here. We didn't go to them. Ireland didn't go to Britain. Britain came to Ireland, and it was a lot of violence. You would think violence started 40 or 60 years ago. We have had 750 years of British violence in Ireland.
Peter,
mass executions.
Peter, thank you. Ben Laurie's the editor of the newsletter. Morning, Ben.
Good morning.
So, former Taoiseach, very much freer now to say what he thinks, and he's saying time for the Irish government to push hard, time for the IRA to apologise more fully, time for the Irish government to apologise, Ben.
Well, what he seems to have done is a double act, which is that all of the Irish, mainstream Irish parties are now talking about
constitutional change and All-Ireland and these mellifluous terms that make it all sound very pleasant. But then he's trying to put in the challenge to Republicans at the same time and saying that the IRA will apologize. I mean, Kevin was saying there about with regard to the apology, oh, you know, these things are difficult and will it be enough for some people and so on. But that's really not the issue here with regard to Sinn Féin. The issue is Sinn Féin apologising when it was inextricably linked with the IRA about past violence. And it's made really crystal clear that it won't do that. And it's not having any difficulty doing making clear that it won't do that. And it's not being put under any pressure to do that. For example, the request that the UK government and that Republicans apologise after Boucher's report on Canova. Sinn Féin has a well-rehearsed form of words, which is that we regret all deaths and pain and so on. And that's often taken at face value, but they're not even close. And there's no sign of them actually saying that what happened was wrong. And they're not being put under any pressure to ask whether what happened was wrong.
Would it make a difference? Would it actually? It'll create news copy. It'll create things for us to talk about, you to write about. But would it actually make a difference to the people who were maimed and hurt? And here we are talking about the IRA. Our top story today, Ben, was about a show of strength from the UVF. 1,500 people on a main arterial route and the police talking about a parade passing without incident. The incident is the show of strength.
Would it make a difference? Well, no, it's not going, not in the sense that it's not going to change the past. It's not going to repair anybody who's been injured. It's not going to bring back anybody who was killed. I think symbolically it would be hugely important, and if that was to happen. But I don't think that that's even on the cards for Sinn Féin, because what's happening, partly because it's not being challenged. I mean, there are people like us who challenge it, but at the newsletter, but it's basically not being challenged. And one of the things that's happening is that more and more of a generation of people who don't remember the violence are thinking, because it isn't challenged, the narrative isn't challenged, that it was necessary and are accepting the Sinn Féin line that it was necessary.
Kevin?
And you have this increase in the ooh-ah up the rah chant on both sides of the border and so on. And something I've often said on broadcasts like this show is that it's almost impolite if you point these things out as we do. It's almost, you know, not quite the right thing. And I when I do it, I almost feel I have to apologise for doing it. So what happened was we had a return to Stormont, and the new Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, First Minister, is essentially a Prime Minister, saying not even being asked. There was no pressure on Michelle O'Neill to clarify. There was no coverage with regard to the day. The only person who was criticised in the return of Stormont was Jim Allister by the DUP when he began to point out some of these things about IRA violence. It's not even being asked. So why would they apologise when they're not being challenged on the past? And one of the things that I've often said is that, and I, for example, often speak and write about legacy. I'm criticised for doing so, and this is being negative and so on. But what's happening is that there has been no, and this is an admirable thing in a way. The IRA killed by far the most people during the Troubles. Republican terrorists killed by far the most people, and people have sort of tried to move on and have tried not to dwell in the past. The people who have raked up the past have been Republicans.
Okay, Kevin Moore,
and they've had a very successful push against the security forces.
I mean, I just note, Stephen, that Ben skated over your question about the show of strength by the UVF. I mean, this is the problem, that we end up with a kind of one-sided account. As I said
sorry,
a few minutes ago...
Can I come in on that, Kevin?
Ben, can I come in? You just spoke on this.
No, I'll tell you why I skated over it.
Let me just finish. Then you come back. It's a one-sided account from you, as it always is. Now, that's great for your copy at the newsletter, constantly relitigating the past, winding up the situation, not moving anything forwards whatsoever. We can't change the past in Northern Ireland, but we can shape the future. And as Bill Clinton wisely put it in politics, stay in the future business. We need to be talking about, if you believe in the union, explain how the union works for everybody. If you believe in a united Ireland, explain how a united Ireland works for everybody. Let that be the centre of our debate, not constantly being pulled into these sidings, which might be good for you, Ben.
Well, it was Leo Varadkar, actually, that brought up the RA apologising for what they did in the past. Obviously, not what they're going to do in the future, Kevin. It's Leo Varadkar's brought this up.
Absolutely. Now, if we're going to have apologies, it's got to be a three-dimensional apology, a three-dimensional approach to the past. Everybody has got blood on their hands. Everyone's got things that they shouldn't have done that they should be regretful for. Everybody. Right, let's start from that basis. And if we're constantly going to relitigate the past and look to score points, then we're never going to get anywhere.
All we're going to do
is keep poking each other in the eye, is all go blind.
You wanted to respond, Ben.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to the me being accused of skating over it. The simple fact of the matter is, I didn't know very much about the show of strength. Last night, we were trying to get in before...
Hold on.
Is there somebody there?
Yeah, go ahead, Ben. Let's let him speak, Kevin. Yes, Ben, you're still there.
Yeah, sorry. Last night I was trying to get Rory McIlroy his near miss on the front page before our deadline. We didn't quite make it, so I was on late. Didn't know much about that. But I can tell you what I think about a show of strength. I think it's both outrageous and unbelievably stupid. It's so first of all, from any shows of strength are obviously wrong. And they're also very, very stupid. And Republicans are much cleverer than this. And they are playing a very successful and difficult to combat PR game. And what I'm saying is this. This is so important to what I'm saying. The IRA violence, Republican violence, 2,160% of people killed in the Troubles was far more than anyone else. And out of decency and politeness and a desire for society to move on, they're not even being challenged about it. So to say that it's good for my copy is, or that I'm doing it for a self-serving reason, it's the very opposite. As I was saying, it's almost I'm being made to look, one of the few people who challenges this, made to look like a villain. And I'm saying, while I understand people's desire to move on from the murder and mayhem and all of the failed tactics of the IRA, which included in the early 70s bombing the hell out of Belfast and then bombing the mainland and all of these terrible things targeting particular types of people, all the tactics shifting and changing over 30 years, that pointing it out is impolite. And the problem with that is that it's rapidly meaning that the IRA is having great success with young people in saying that something that wasn't important, necessary, that was entirely rejected by voters in the Republic and mostly rejected by voters in nationalists in Northern Ireland, that is winning. And somebody has to challenge it. And to then spring on me and suggest that I'm being hypocritical about a despicable show of strength, which at this particular time I don't know a lot about, is wrong.
Well, there were 15, the police are saying and guiding us that the 1,500 people that were on the street were there as part of tensions, ongoing tensions within the UVF. And there's what looks like a couple of community police officers at the front of this parade. The parade was a legal parade. But 1,500 people coming out in black trousers, white shirts, black ties, Ben. You know what that looks like. You know what that is. And it was organised.
I mean, I said that. It's just appalling. It's outrageous. And it's the last thing we need. And you're telling me that this is about feuds and stuff? I mean, it's sickening, laughable.
You see,
terrible.
I think,
but I'm sorry on this particular. I didn't know we were going to be discussing.
And I brought you on for something else.
That what Leo Varadkar said was what Sinn Féin has done is very, very.
But look,
tricky about the violence.
I think a significant question. We've run this as our top story today. The UVF show of strength. I think a significant question within that story is the transition money, is the money. Should, in the context, as I said earlier, of people being told that there isn't enough money for vital services around Northern Ireland, is Stormont ever going to look at a deadline for this money that is being funneled and reaches In some groups, it reaches very legitimate groups who are trying to stop violence. Absolutely, they are. But some of this money, our money, finds its way to the gangsters who have this little ongoing excuse, we're transitioning. Is anybody in Northern Ireland who has got power going to call a date for the end to transitioning? Is that a fair question, Kevin? When does the transitioning stop?
It is a fair question. Here we are, 26 years later, supposedly in a different era, a different period, and we still have the presence, the nefarious presence of loyalist paramilitaries. Now, I just to be slightly counterintuitive, perhaps, I don't mind money going towards groups that are trying to transition people out of one silo and into mainstream society. I think that's a good thing. I think it's necessary simply because often loyalist communities have got appalling social and economic problems and often have got, frankly...
I'll tell you the appalling social economic problems they've got. They can't get proper housing. This applies across the different communities. They can't... Their school buildings are crumbling. They're sitting on waiting lists, for goodness sake, and we're still paying transitioning money.
Yeah. No, let me tell you the difference, though. Loyalist communities are let down by lousy political representation. That's the big problem. The DUP, the UUP, middle-class parties that do not speak to working class communities and their interests and their issues. And loyalists need, frankly, to demand better political leadership and representation. That's the big difference between loyalists and Republicans.
Okay.
Sinn Féin, even Ben concedes this point, an effective political organisation.
Neil's calling us from Wicklow.
For their community.
Morning, Neil.
Loyalists don't get that.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Okay, thank you. Are you getting any transitioning money? Are you getting any? Am I getting any? Is the little old lady sitting in the house getting any that's sitting with a possible cancer and is sitting on a waiting list these days? Or some kid that has a tube down their throat that we were reporting on last week? Multiple children with tubes down their throat. They're sitting on waiting lists in order to get PEG operations, and we are sending transitioning money to people that don't understand. Stop. Just stop.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, I mean,
stop.
We know there is a shortage of public service money. There isn't enough, and it's not targeted at exactly the right places. I agree entirely with you. See, I was calling just to add, because I'm very moved by the whole conversation. You've covered just about everything and nearly so much history and poor gentleman who lost his father. But reconciliation is the prerequisite and also the postrequisite. It's reconciliation is the key, and we have to move into the direction of reconciliation. And there are many, many people in Northern Ireland who are well experienced. There are others from abroad who have helped from time to time. And so whatever way we work out our future together, I mean, it involves all this. And that includes Ireland. I mean, I'm in Wicklow now, the home of Parnell. The Ireland-England ancient antipathies need to be resolved. And that can be begun as well. It's not just within our own place. I'm working mostly in Belfast. I want to add that, like the reconciliation word, we know about it.
Neil,
we need to work it.
Thank you.
Apology isn't enough.
Thank you for calling today. Ben, we'll leave last word to you this morning. Thank you, Neil. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, the first thing is that if you have, look at the Second World War. If you have, I like you, Stephen, was born in the early 1970s, less than 30 years after the end of the war. And when it's something that massive, people have to move on in a way. And because ours was less big, maybe in a way it's easier for us not to move on. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing about the money that you raised there, I've long time been concerned about cultural money and where it goes and what real audit there is of it. And the very large amount of monies that are going across the society to cultural groups that are not properly understood, I feel. Yeah. And it's very hard for those of us journalists when we look at it to understand it or get to the bottom of it without putting people
on. Let me tell you something, Ben. It was like
I think it's a massive problem. You see, in answer to your question.
You see when the Nolan Show started looking at the social investment fund, do you remember that? It was like a bomb went off in some parts of Stormont. The reaction that there was quite significant. I was called up, for goodness sake, and we conversations were had with me about it.
And never forget that, that things like potholes will get really serious problems in the health service, we all know about, which is much more serious than potholes. But even small things like potholes...
We've got to leave it there. Ben, thank you. Kevin, thank you. Are we ever going to hear the end of it? England won last night. They scored one goal. Superstars, no doubt. Are we ever going to hear the end of this? But here's another question. Now that Northern Ireland, of course, aren't there, obviously, Scotland, they got thrashed by Germany. Republic of Ireland, not there. Would Northern Irish supporters and Republic of Ireland supporters, would they have a tendency to support England more than they would support Germany or any other club? Are you going to get in behind England or Scotland, for example? Goodness help us, we're actually going to replay, as if this hasn't been replayed enough, where they scored their one goal last night.
Here's Walker on the right-hand side, looking for the run of Saka. Good pass. Saka now with a chance to cross, and Bellingham is there! With a header in the six-yard box, England take the lead! And it is that man who opens the door for England! It's coming,
football's coming. And of course, it hasn't come home yet, has it? No matter how many times they tell us, not even close. Proud England fan, he's going to be an irritant today as well. Mike Parry, good morning, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Stephen.
Even more of an irritant than you usually are. The Belfast Telegraph's night editor, John Laverty, with us. Good morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Are you excited? Have you got your England underpants on to celebrate your one goal last night, Mike?
Well, no. I mean, look, it wasn't an emphatic victory, but it was a victory. It was the first game for us in the tournament. There was a bit of hesitancy, but
pretty
we did
dismal,
most things.
Wasn't it?
No, it wasn't dismal.
Boring.
Think about it, we switched it off.
It was that boring. We switched it off. And
well,
I'll tell
you,
we watched a 20-year-old movie, The Equalizer, because it was awful.
Yeah, good for you. Now, let me tell you this. In 1966, we drew against Uruguay at Wembley, a home tournament, and everybody was doom and gloom. So if you get through your first... But we went on to win it, of course. But if you get through your first game with a victory against a very tough Serbian side, all we've got to do now is beat Denmark in our next game, and then we're through to the... out of the group and into the qualifying stages. It was a very, very solid performance without being spectacular. But to answer your second question, should the people of Ireland get behind England? Of course they should. I would be shouting for Northern Ireland or Scotland or Wales if they were in the tournament and we weren't.
Sorry,
because
no, you wouldn't.
I'm a member of the union. Yes,
I observe punters like you all the time. You don't even
know anything about me, Stephen. I'd be very careful in you rating what and how I support football teams.
So you acknowledge Northern Ireland even exists, do you, when England are also playing?
Of course I do. I was in Northern Ireland on the night in 2005 when Northern Ireland beat England 1-0. It was an amazing night. It was a great night for you. And I shared in the joy of the Northern Irish people, even though I'm English and we got beaten, because it meant so much to the people of Northern Ireland. And so I would like to see them progress in European and world football. Norman Whiteside is a big mate of mine, right? You know what a significant figure he is in Northern Irish football. So I wish the people of Northern Ireland well in all future competitions.
John Laverty, do you expect, should we expect Northern Ireland football supporters to get in behind England?
Northern Ireland football supporters, Stephen, yes. I think all Northern Ireland football supporters will be wishing England well, unless, of course, England are playing Northern Ireland, like, as was mentioned earlier, they did in 2005 when they beat them at Windsor Park. But Northern Ireland being football being tribal, Stephen, and Northern Ireland, of course, being divided in a sectarian side of things, it won't be the gap for everybody in Northern Ireland, obviously. I think almost a 50-50, you know, most Northern Ireland supporters will want England to do very well in this competition, but a large number of people here will not, and will be supporting ABE, anybody but England.
Why is that? Why not get in behind them?
Well, first of all, Stephen, as you know, I used to be a football correspondent, and I've I covered lots of England games, especially at the big tournaments like the Euros and the World Cup. And I loved covering England. I mean, most of the players were great, people like David Beckham.
No, no, turn that off. I'm not having that in the background. Thank you. Sorry, carry on, John.
People like David Beckham and Frank Lampard were very helpful, and most of the managers were very helpful as well. It's not the players. It's not the players. It's not the manager. I think that a lot of people get annoyed with the jingoism, you know, and the tongue thumping that goes on.
The hype from people like Parry. If they were pretty dismal last night. There was Bellingham.
No. Yeah. Stephen, at least we're in the competition and your team aren't. Obviously, I accept you're a much smaller country than England. But also, a point to make to my colleague there is that there is huge support in Northern Ireland for clubs in England, for Liverpool and Everton and Manchester United. And therefore, Everton, without a shadow of a doubt, mate.
For Everton.
I've got mates in Ireland who support Everton. I can, don't worry about that. No. And look, I was going to say, you've also got to accept the fact that we are one country if it's the United Kingdom, OK? Now, as you probably know, Stephen, because you're a bit of an historical buff, the economic boom in Germany started in 1954 when Germany beat Hungary in the World Cup final against the odds. That literally triggered the boom in Germany and the boom across Europe. It would trigger an economic boom here if England win this competition, and that would extend to all the countries in the United Kingdom. Therefore, they have a patriotic duty, those people of Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales, to support England to the hilt in this competition.
But there's no such thing as a patriotic duty when you've got four different regions of the same United Kingdom.
Yes, but we're not playing, John. Obviously, if we're not playing, could we not bring it upon ourselves to go out and buy an England shirt?
Well, I wouldn't think anybody would go that far here, but
if I could get one to fit me, should I go and put an England shirt on?
No.
There's not enough material in Northern Ireland to make a shirt to fit you, Stephen, with the greatest respect.
No, Mike wears his heart on his sleeve, and there's nothing wrong with that.
He's got about two bellies flopping over his trousers for a start. Don't know he's doing talking about me.
That's a bit harsh.
The problem I have and a lot of people have is, you know, I say Mike wears his heart on his sleeve, but, you know, when people in the media also do the same thing and forget that the UK is four regions, not just one, I think that's whenever people start getting resentful of the England team. Yeah. Not the players, not the manager, and not the guys who play for Liverpool and Manchester United, who are the two the only two teams really that get any support here in Northern Ireland.
I wouldn't expect anybody from one of the other countries to wear an England shirt. I think they should have passive support for England. But what I do object to are those who are anti-English because their team is not there and the England team are. That is just mischief-making. It's unnecessary. And I was born in Chester, which is right on the northern border of Wales. I've got friends in Northern Ireland. I've worked with footballers like Ray Houghton and Alan Brazil from Scotland. So to me, we are all great countries. Some of us have better fortunes in football tournaments than others, but I support every one of them.
John Lisburn, you watched through your son, did you?
Sorry?
Yes, I can enjoy a good football match. The England match was a terrible match, to watch.
Wasn't it boring?
No, I'd rather support Albania or somebody who goes out actually with passion, you know, the underdogs. I mean,
did you find it boring last night, John?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, sorry, you're talking
about these guys are paid copious amounts of money. They're multimillionaires, and they go out and piddle about, and they're holding their knees, and they're going down, and they're trying to get, you know, that's not football. That's acting. You know, that's what that is. And I object, I suppose, to the fact that they are divas. I'd rather watch...
Now, would you... We ran a little thing. It was a couple of years ago where we got Do You Swing Both Ways T-shirts done. And we were asking people if they could swing to the Republic of Ireland, support them, then swing and support Northern Ireland. Could you swing? Should we send you a T-shirt, John?
Free clothes are always welcome.
Yes, but would you wear it?
No, I wouldn't wear that one because
it says on the front of it, "I swing both ways."
It, it would have sexual connotations. I'm sorry about that.
No, but it's not sexual, for goodness sake. It's about football.
I know it's about football, but, you know, there's a guy on there. Why the English FA stopped the home country's tournament? Was it because Northern Ireland were beating all these divas? Or Scotland were beating them, or Wales were beating them?
John,
you know, they've got a pride attitude.
John?
They've got a haughty
John Laverty, the Belfast Telegraph. Yes, John.
Yeah, he's talking about the British Home Championships, which, of course, were abandoned a few years ago. The last winners, of course, were Northern Ireland. So we are the defending champions. But what I was thinking, Stephen, I mentioned earlier about the jingoism and the tub thumping, which, of course, is what Mike has been showing this morning.
Yes.
But,
not at all. Support for my country, that's not jingoism. That's patriotic support.
Mike, and I have nothing against that, but my point is, whenever England do go out, and the men's team have done, obviously, they haven't won anything since 1966, which you keep your mind of, the nastiness that the same people display against the England team is just appalling. You know, as people like David Beckham will show whenever he was sent off in 1998.
And
of course, Rooney a few years later. It turns from the jingoism, the tub-thumping, to absolute nastiness. And if and when England go out, you come onto this programme the next morning, Mike, and let's see you defending England the way you're defending them now.
I do not expect us to go out.
They always do go out, Mike.
No,
I think we're talking about the victors when we talk about England, and I won't have all this nonsense that it was a boring game.
Alan,
football
matches
sometimes are tactical, and you have to appreciate
tactical.
Them for that.
The BBC pundits were more entertaining. Alan Shearer was more entertaining last night than the players on that pitch, with the exception of Bellingham. Bellingham was a bit of magic dust. Michael and South Belfast.
We saw the emergence of a brand new defender, Guéhi. He's a fantastic lad from Crystal Palace. He was the outstanding player last night. So that is one great positive from that game. We found another world-class defender in an England shirt.
Michael, good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen. Triandrum Road, where you were born. Let's face it, Stephen, some years ago I had some mighty crack with you, and you actually rewarded me with a sweatshirt.
Yes.
Whereby my team, Celtic, had got a great result against Barcelona. And I said to you, what would you know about football, Mr. Nolan? You spend your Saturdays watching your Kevin Lacey DVDs with your bargain bucket and your prawn cocktails, and let's face it, you're not a football fan and you have no appreciation of it.
I watch these football matches. I did have a Manchester United season ticket. When they started being boring, I dumped that season ticket, dumped that team, transferred over to Liverpool. And look, I go to these things for a sense of event. I was going to Vegas for Conor McGregor in a week's time, and he's called that off now for an injury.
Well,
I go for the sense of event. So when I watched that match last night, and it was, I'm telling you, we started flicking through Netflix and found The Equalizer, a 20-year-old movie, was much more exciting than that lot. And they score one goal, and Mike Parry is ecstatic.
Yeah, but Stephen, you're just a football philistine. You're a philistine in football terms. Yeah, know nothing about it.
I was in the pub. I watched the first half. England played well. I spent the last half texting people all over the world about my dog and about the beautiful weather here and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a pity you have such an empty life, mate.
Is there a hint of arrogance, Michael, about the England pundits and commentary, that do they think that their team is better than everybody else, but just is so unlucky they keep losing?
Not at all. We don't have that. I mean, you must have heard the commentators on the continent in South America, you know, goal! I mean, they are pure fans who are pretending to be the commentators in the game. Our commentators, the journalists that cover the England games, are the most professional and detached in the world of broadcasting.
I like Alan Shearer. Alan in North Belfast. Morning, Alan.
What about you, Stephen?
Doing all right, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Listen, to see that match last night, it was nearly as boring as the pundits.
Yes.
Gary Lineker, 3.2 million. Alan Shearer.
No.
They're nearly as boring as you.
I like
the BBC.
I like
the Lineker. BBC.
Lineker's good.
The BBC, in my words, stands for Boring British Corporation.
And yet you're listening to it.
There's no laughter. There's no. When you go on to ITV, you have Roy Keane, you have Gary Neville, Ian Wright, you have proper footballers. You're talking and telling you a bit of a laugh and a joke.
Aye, because Lineker's not a proper footballer, right enough. The former captain of England isn't a proper footballer.
Well, let me ask you this. You're such a football genius.
Yes.
Who did Gary Lineker play for?
I have absolutely no notion.
Well, of course you have. He's played for Everton. He scored 40 goals for Everton in one season.
I don't know anything about these people, Alan, nor do I pretend to.
I wasn't asking you. What do you call the English keeper, Stephen?
What?
What do you call the English goalkeeper?
When I was a young boy, I had...
He's another Evertonian, Jordan Pickford, by the way.
I want to know about your young boy stories. I'm asking you...
When I was a young boy, I had Bruce Grobbelaar goalkeeping gloves. Do you remember him?
I do.
He used to walk on his hands. That's why he had gloves.
I
he used to walk
him.
On his hands.
Stephen,
I think from your era, bearing in mind the age you are, Danny Blanchflower would have been your hero, wouldn't he?
You don't even know who Danny Blanchflower is.
Alan, you see, if you say the BBC is so boring, what are you doing listening to this programme? You love it, don't you? You absolutely love it.
It's because I'm on.
You just put me up and asked me to come on, that's why. All right, you're
you phoned
in,
you clamped. Were you watching the match last night?
A load of rubbish. And listen, to see that Kanye Lissy DVD you have down there?
Yes.
Is that then you had about 7 years ago? Have you got my Billy Idol CD by any chance too?
Your what?
I can lend you out. My Billy Idol CD.
Dolly Island.
Billy Idol.
What's this man? Billy Idol.
Yes. Did I not lend you a CD years ago with Billy Idol and you haven't given me it back?
Can I just
along with Kanye and Lissy?
Can I just be very clear? I have no idea who this man is. Right. Thank you very much, Alan. Thank you. John Laverty. Thank you. Mike Parry. Always good.
Yep, thank you, Peter. Stephen, I was going to call you Peter. Thank you, Peter Shilton, I was thinking of. He's talking about goalkeepers. Right, Stephen, thank you very much. Talk again soon.
All the very best. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. King's Birthday Honours List revealed over the weekend. One of the local names being recognised is Martin McGowan, organ donation campaigner, father of Yon Dahi, of course, who's appeared on many NOLA live shows, inspiration behind the so-called Dahi's Law. Good morning to you, Martin.
Good morning, Stephen. How's it going?
It's going okay.
A bit of chaos this morning on the show. Wow, I'm here.
That's an England crowd. Congratulations. What does this mean to you?
Thank you, Stephen. It's just, it's massive recognition for all our work with Dahi's Law and Donate for Dahi. It's been a tough, very tough couple of years. And you know what? We find ourselves in a situation now, you know, compared to a couple of years ago when we were knocking on doors and getting doors closed on our faces. And now just, you know, we feel like the tables have turned a wee bit. And we just found out as well that Dahi's Law, you know, 1 year anniversary there on the 1st of June. And we found out that lives have been saved through Dahi's Law. So
tell us about Dahi's Law, Martin, and what it does.
Dahi's Law is basically, so you've got the NHS organ donor register, and Dahi's Law is an opt-out system where you now opt out. It's a soft opt-out system where you opt out of organ donation instead of opting in. Therefore, if you haven't recorded a decision, and if you die in circumstances when you can donate organs, you will consider to be a supporter of organ donation. However, your family will always have that last say. And so that means that there was 14 organ donors last year that didn't record a decision and that their family then supported that they would go on to donate their organs through Dahi's Law. So to hear that there was 14 organ donors and, you know, all the other statistics going along with Dahi's Law, the registrations to the NHS organ donation were up, the consent rate was up, everything was kind of up. So it was just such a celebratory couple of days.
Where do you record the decision?
So it takes 2 minutes. So on the NHS organ donation website, it's just the register's been there for years.
And do you register also your double confirmation that you want to be opted in, or do you only register if you want to opt out?
So you have two now, Stephen. So, well, you could always register. You could always register to opt in and opt out. So The thing is, we will always still encourage people to join. Number one, join the organ donor register. Take the 2 minutes to join the register, and then share your wishes with your loved one. That will always remain the number one goal. Dahi's Law is a wee bit of a safety net there. But then it is a soft opt-out system, so we would tell people as well that if you're so against it, go and opt-out as well. It takes 2 minutes.
And someone like me, unhealthy, fat, all the rest of it, would my organs be any good?
Totally.
Would they be of any thing. Use to people?
Well, 100%. Stephen, this is the thing that we'll tell people as well.
Hello, imagine having a Nolan inside you, for goodness sake. You'd be...
No, well, do you know what? What happens is a medical professional will then make that decision. So you have to remember that out of all the deaths, only 1% of deaths result in organ donation. So we want every single person to make a decision, because there's so little deaths result in organ donation that we want everybody we want everybody to support, but we want everybody to make a decision whether they would like to donate or not.
You've connected with people like some politicians would kill for. Do you think it was you, or with all due respect, do you think it was young Dahi did the connection?
Well, I think it would be, you know what, definitely Dahi helps make that condition, because he's the story. So everything in our, you know, all the strategies end at the storytelling. So it's how we tell that story. And then, you know, if you speak to the likes of Chris Heaton-Harris, or the likes of Paul Given or Michelle Neal, you know, the big players within Dahi's Law, they will tell you that, you know, it was meeting our family and it was ultimately meeting Dahi. But it's us as a family who choose to put Dahi out there, to share his story and to make him the face of the campaign.
You're from West Belfast. Was it in any way a difficult decision to decide to receive this honour from the King, accept it?
You know what, Stephen? It was a very difficult decision. And I'm not just from West Belfast, Stephen. I'm from Ballymurphy. And, you know, as somebody from Ballymurphy accepting an award like this, it's very difficult because of the past in Ballymurphy. You know, the likes of the atrocities and the likes of the Ballymurphy massacre and the Spring Hill massacre, and, you know, the people who have suffered now growing up with that. However, I think that my community is a very confident community, and that they will understand the reasoning behind me accepting this award, because I feel that Dahi's Law totally transcends politics, and, you know, Dahi has campaigned everything. And to be honest, I've had about 95% positive responses. And if I can just make one point, is that a few released a statement and I said this, that, and the other, and, you know, a few people have come back to me and said, you know, whatever helps you sleep at night. And I'll tell you and your listeners now that I do struggle to sleep at night, Stephen. But it's not because I've accepted this award. I struggle to sleep at night because I think of our Dahi not receiving the gift of life. I think of our Dahi dying every single day.
How's he doing?
That is what keeps me up at night. So I just wanted to make that point as well, that, you know, everything's bigger. To me, everything Dahi is the most important thing.
How's he doing, Martin?
He's doing well. I think he's back over for another operation in November. Just to find out everything that's going on and all that.
Another operation.
So he was suspended from the list around about this time last year for, you know, the collaterals. I said that there were like weeds growing around his heart. So these grow back. They're like weeds. They grow back, and they have to get these under control. So it's looking like he'll probably have at least one operation every, you know, maybe every year until he gets the gift of a new heart. So our lives are just always kind of on alert. We never really get to just breathe, and we're always just worried, even though he's stable
and
now.
Quickly. Does he need a heart from a child the same age as him?
It's not necessarily the same age. It's all to do with the weight, Stephen, and the weight in the room in there, and, you know, how it would fit along with the... we've been told before that he could get a heart maybe up to 3 times his weight. So may say he's 17 kilos now. So it could be as old as a small teenager maybe, but that's just, you know, speculation really. But yes, it would be a child. And the thing is that because, you know,
there are a lot less organ donors, pediatric organ donors, is that that's why Dahi has waited so long and why he'll probably continue to wait so long. So we're just our nerves are always racked, basically.
And as time goes on, does it become more and more difficult for him? Does his situation deteriorate as time goes on?
Well, that's exactly what happens, is that Dahi can't, you know, his condition can't improve without the gift of a new heart. So he's kind of slowly declining, and I'm happy that I can say slowly, but, you know, Dahi's going to be 8 on his next birthday in October, and all his wee mates are, you know, joining boxing clubs and playing football and, you know, doing all the things that he wants to do. And, you know, that's affecting him massively, as in, you know, just him seeing all his mates. Easter, he said to me on the way in this morning, he says, Daddy, will you ask my classroom assistant, will you let me hit a couple of penalties today? So even Dahi just jumping out of the way and hitting a penalty, his oxygen levels just drop. You know, he's very little. He's very... But do you know what? The thing is, he's the biggest fighter I know. And I always explain to him when he gets the gift of a new heart that he'll be able to... The world will be his oyster.
Martin, you're a fantastic father. And thanks for being on the radio with us this morning. Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. See you in the morning.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavors, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.